have any landscape studies now. And today he's going to be telling us about new developments where he's been aligning those ideas with the complexities.
Thanks. Thanks. It's, thanks for inviting me. Okay, so this talk will have something for everybody. I'll try to begin with a very brief overview of where we are in string theory and how we might hope to test the theory, how we you know, the picture of compactification that might lead to some realistic model, and some slightly technical, but really a caricature of the real technical discussion and how one does that. And then I'll focus on a particular aspect of that problem, I think, with the cosmological constant. And that's a problem where there's a very nice simplification that one can look at. I'll get to that model in due course and study the general problem. Suppose, well, you know, if there's one of the things you could have said, you know, for a long time, we can say it, we can start to say it in string theory. Suppose you really knew the laws of nature, okay, but you had to compute to figure out the predictions, you know, the particle masses, the other quantities that we observe. Well, how hard would that be? Is it conceivable that we could have a light theory right in front of us, but the computations would be so difficult that we could never decide if the theory was, you know, really fitting the data or not? Okay, well, I'll argue that that's not impossible. Okay, let's see such. Okay, so so you know, I'm sure there's been many talks, and people have heard some of the basics of string theory by now. There was this original sort of mid-80s picture of the theory where we quantize one-dimensional objects moving in 10-dimensional space-time, and we get out what looks like a consistent theory of quantum gravity coupled to Young-Mills, coupled to the other components that we would need to make up the standard model that describes the observed forces and matter. Okay, so people have made significant progress in convincing themselves of that, not really being able to prove it or give some mathematical definition, but very good evidence. But it's all in 10 dimensions, and at this point, one falls back on much older ideas going back to Kaluza and Klein, that say that the 10-dimensional space-time in which all this is moving is some small 6-dimensional manifold M, usually taken to be compact, across the 3+1 dimensional space-time that we know and love, and sort of the approximation flat Minkowski space-time. And so now one studies the theory on this space, having postulated the metric on M, having postulated various other data. There could be other fields in the underlying string theory, other objects that one puts in, and derives from this. So geometry of M, some moderately complicated, but explicit procedure turns into the spectrum and interactions of particles in 4 dimensions. So I'll say a little bit more about this later. So this was a picture of circa 1985. Circa 1995, a huge amount of progress was made in understanding the sense in which different string theories are connected together, and what could happen if, say, the string interaction at the coupling constant became large. So there's this subject of duality, where one makes conjectures of this sort that if I start with a certain type of string, let's say a certain heterotic string, and I increase the string coupling constant, And in the limit, if it becomes very large, this becomes some other thread, let's say, the type 1 open thread, in which the new coupling concept, G type 1, is inversely related. So now it's becoming small. And again, it's a remarkable structure. One of these things where nobody, you know, the people who worked on this in 1992 were all considered crackpots by the scientific community. And by 1995, pretty much everybody was convinced. And it wasn't just because Witten gave a talk on it, although that's a significant part. You know, they really are convincing arguments. And so anyhow, this has produced at least the glimmerings of this you know, very nice picture of a unique theory with obviously far more intricate structure than anything that we could just kind of dream up, you know, and aren't we clever? This, you know, people will often say, you know, the string theory is more clever than us. And this is the sort of thing that they are referring to. Okay, so we've made this progress. Now, in 2005, opinions differ. Some would say that we've taken steps back. I would prefer to say that we are still coming to grips with the intricacies and the implications of this. Okay, so again, the basic picture, I promise to give a slightly more technical discussion. So a nice class of six-dimensional manifold is the Clausius manifold. It's nice because one has a theorem in this case that proves that Ricci flat metrics, solutions of Einstein's equations, exist. And you can characterize them by nice simple equations, you know, so one polynomial five variables at zero, you know, in projective space. You know, the simplest example of a Clausius. And then by very clever and complicated arguments, one implicitly shows that, well, yes, this guy had a Ricci flat metric, although we can't write it down. So it does solve Einstein's equation. It does admit all the other structures that have string compactification created. And we can start computing and try to realize this. Okay, so there are various ways, and something which is sort of more pictorial developed in this late 90s period is to take your manifold and embed what are called grains, take various minimal volume submanifolds like spheres, cycles of various dimensions, and embed grains on them, submanifolds which themselves can carry gauge fields on which strings might be forced to live and so forth, and try to get the structure of the theory from that. Okay, so an example of a construction of this type is we know that Yang-Mills theory with this gauge group is part of the universe. We observe these three interactions. What does this tell us about the internal space and this other data? Well, very generally it tells us that yes, whatever the structure is, it must have a symmetry like this at each point in space-time. And then that continuous symmetry does become the gauge group of the three-plus-one dimensional world that we see. Well, there are many ways you could have that symmetry. One way you could have it is by taking one of these manifolds and having three grains, three individual surfaces of the same topology really embedding into the same sphere, and then there's some unitary rotation. In the sense you can superpose these things and you'll decide that indeed this has SU3 symmetry just by virtue of that choice. Okay, so that's the favorable sort of case where we see something and we can just kind of design it into the compactification. And to the extent that we can do that, we're very happy. You know, we have not predicted something about the real world, but which we fit it in this very direct way. Okay, so now other data of this sort. We know there are quarks that have charges both under SU3 and SU2. There's a popular class of models that explains that by saying that there are two other grains having some other cycle that intersect these ones, and then the open strings are stretched from one choice of the three grains here. So you pick one, and then the string stretches over to one choice out of these two grains over here. Well, that produces a choice which transforms into three, that's three, three component vector classes, two component vectors, just like three, four. So that's good. That's, again, accomplishing this goal of we saw something that works, and we've kind of directly reproduced it in the geometry. Okay, but the last, of course, it's not all that simple. Okay, so one problem is that locally these things often aren't this simple, but then there are complicated global consistency conditions. So as an example, it might be in a given model that the total number of brains, so n brains, let's say, is 40. Okay, and these numbers, you know, tend to be of order, you know, 10, hundreds, okay. So I just pulled 40 out of the hat. And at this point, all you can say is, well, you know, it's consistent with this. We needed six brains, it would seem. And for all we know, there are 34 other brains. You know, maybe they don't come, they give rise to gay groups. Maybe they give rise to gay groups in matter we don't see. You know, there's dark matter out there. It's like to take 28% of the energy density of the universe, the visible baryonic matter is only 4%. Maybe there's other forms of matter which interact among themselves, which have to do with these hidden brains. We don't know. You know, we can postulate it in the string theory and back to the connection, or we can try to find some other explanation of that fact. Maybe it's a type of matter we can't see. But we just have these simple sorts of constraints that limit the possibility. Okay, so when you start getting into the details of this, you get much more complicated Diophantine conditions along numbers of brains, intersection numbers, wrappings of brains among cycles. And so one faces moderately complicated problems of here are, you know, let's say 40 Diophantine equations and 50 variables, you know, list all the solutions. Okay, and well, this already starts to sound difficult. And one might be led to ask, well, you know, how do you do it? Is it difficult? Is it not difficult? Okay. We don't know. You know, we just have control of a few corners of this space of convective occasions, and we'd like to get some sort of general handle. You know, is it really true that, as this example might suggest, there are typically lots of hidden sectors in string theory that we don't see? Could they be responsible for properties that we hypothesize, such as supersymmetry and breaking, that we don't see? And the problem involves both the sort of geometry or physics of deciding what are brains and strings and their properties, geometry and deciding how can they embed and so forth, what are the possible manifolds, and then this computational aspect. Well, we get it down to a level of problem. You know, can we actually list the possibilities? Okay, so in the first instance, this idea of the landscape. So what is the landscape? It's a very generic and old term. The original use of the term wasn't talking about fitness landscapes in biology. You think of organisms as optimizing some sort of a fitness. Okay, and then much later, physicists talked about the, you know, say landscape of some configuration, you know, some set of atoms that can form molecules. You can move them around and calculating effective potential for the various function of the various positions of nuclei, and the various molecules would be these. And it's a very general consequence of having complicated systems of any type, especially physical systems, and many variables, such as the many possibilities I talked about here. And my own point of view is that you know, we're just trying now to not look at one example or think that we couldn't. Again, it's a little bit very nice if we could just take the facts and directly encode them in this diagram. And unfortunately, to some extent, it's an inverse problem where we know how to make these things, and some of them fit the data and some don't. We just have to just link through the space and find the possibilities which fit the known data and see if they make want to make other predictions.
So one question.
Yeah.
When you said that typically you have a number of brains being 40 or 100 or so,
right.
Is it typically because of what one expects typically, or does it, is it kind of a theorem?
So there's specific numbers that control its topological invariant. So one important topological invariant in these things would be the Denny numbers. So for example, this particular one has B3 equals 204. Okay, so you know, the basis for the third cohomology. Okay, this number in the simplest constructions is the second trim class of the tangent bundle. So it's another computable topological invariant. I think it's actually 40 or 50 for one day. And so these numbers come out of topological invariants, which somehow by the nature of this problem. Okay, so at this point, it's this. Well, people have gone through this. People don't even know the number of these Calabi-Yau's. This is the most studied category of manifolds. They don't know the number is finite, but out of their own constructions, the Euler numbers and numbers like this range up into the few hundreds.
So how did I get to 10 to the
500? I didn't get there yet.
Okay.
So why should there be such a huge number, and why should we believe it there? Okay, so now let me first introduce a priori, not I shouldn't say a priori, a reason, an argument based on observation, why there should be a lot of value. Okay, so there's this famous problem of the cosmological constant. So we have Einstein's equations. Pi t, and then plus this cosmological constant term lambda, which plays exactly the same role as a constant Lorentz invariant energy density. Okay, so anything that produces energy in the vacuum and does not violate Lorentz invariant, so you can call it the vacuum, contributes to this. And so it's a famous problem, again, I'm not sure people here know, to explain why observations require are only fit by an incredibly tiny value of this term. Okay, so this problem also evolved. So of course, in the early days, Einstein thought it would be perhaps better to keep space stable and have a standard cosmology. Of course, the universe is expanding, and that can be easily modeled with lambda. Zero. For quite a while, there was no convincing evidence that suggested anything else other than zero, but definitely evidence that it was far, far smaller than any other scale in at least part fundamental physics. I mean, it's not a, if you convert, this is an energy density, if you use h bar and c to convert it into units of length, it's what, something like 100 microns to the minus 4. So it's actually not a ridiculous scale from some point of view, but if you compared it to the Planck energy, which would be the natural units, so therefore Planck energy density is of order 10 to the 9 to 22. So compared to this natural scale of quantum gravity, it's ridiculously small. So this is, for quite a while, just an observational constraint, small of this order. Okay, another thing you could compare it to is the mass of the proton or the electron. Let's say proton, you get something like 10 to the minus 50 m proton to the fourth. Okay, so tiny from the point of view of particle physics. Okay, so for quite a while, people thought that there was something about the theory that would make this zero, even though there was never really any clear sign of that within string theory. It was generally thought to be a flaw in string theory that somehow, or better yet, the flaw in our understanding. So the flip side, of course, of the things I was saying at the beginning is that if we don't solve this problem, of course, it's not string theory that's at fault. It's us that's at fault, and that may or may not be true. But in this case, people felt that probably the correct understanding would lead to this lambda being zero, and that would clarify a lot of things. Okay, so this changed, of course, with astronomical evidence in the late 90s, careful studies of distant supernovas, various related observations, and especially the I would say the WMAP data, I guess 2003, the original WMAP data, very much confirmed the idea that lambda is definitely greater than zero, and in fact it's about 0.71 of the critical energy density. And so makes up the preponderance of the energy in the universe and has this, you know, very definite non-zero value, you know, consistent, you know, at least the same order of these tiny numbers we talked about, but definitely non-zero. Okay, so definitely the evidence for some sort of dark energy seems, if not incontrovertible, at least, you know, very, very widely accepted. The evidence that it's literally cosmological constant and not something else, you can debate. Okay, and I'm, for reasons of time, just going to assume it's a cosmological constant. If you want, we can come back and discuss the alternatives, but from the point of view of speaking, they're all very similar. They tend to have to do with slight time variations, which then would, in principle, in the far distant future, relax down to some definite, you know, value, and why that should not be, why that should be small as a comparable time. Okay, so anyhow, if we now to simplify, grant that we have this tiny non-zero number, okay, so all the quantum contributions and virtual fluctuations on contributions to the energy add up to this incredibly tiny number, well, you know, there's some sort of a cosmic conspiracy going on. And what could it be? Well, again, people have looked, you know, very actively, you know, for zero and for small. And there's very hard to produce mechanisms that would do this. Basically, from the point of view of field theory, more or less whatever you can do, you can add all sorts of stuff, but at the end of the day, you always free to shift this, and so there's no obvious reason why it should take a particular value. And you know, it's very hard to imagine an argument then that will force it to take, you know, this non-zero particular value. And then, you know, string theory, well, maybe far beyond what we know, as I say, no evidence from what we see. So that's okay. So where could it come from? Okay, well, there's a sort of a null hypothesis which says that, well, we have this large multiplicity of choices, and really, according to our present understanding of string theory, what we would do, string theory starts off with no parameters. We have made choices at this point. We've made various choices of the topology of the manifold, these rings and so forth. Okay. Well, now we have, for example, the size and the shape of the manifold. So suppose we talk about, you know, the absolute size or, you know, let's say diameter of the internal dimension. So, you know, in principle, an observable thing. Once you get down to distances shorter than this diameter, you would get deviations of the inverse square law of gravity. So if it were big enough, you could see that. So suppose it's too small to see that. Well, nevertheless, you will get, you know, particles of mass, one of the diameter. So an interesting thing. And what determines it? Okay, and the first question is, you ask, why is it determined at all? You know, the Einstein's equations are scale invariant. If we drop this, again, tiny on the scales we're talking about, we can just rescale any solution. If we start off with the diameter being something, we can scale that to be something else. Okay, so what determines that? Okay, well, we better understand that before we can understand what determines that. Well, the basic answer over here, now I'm getting to the, you know, deeper significance of this point of view here, is that in most physical problems, what determines the value of fields. Okay, so in principle, this is not something you feed in. This is some sort of a field which is allowed to vary at different points in space and time. It could be the Coriolis slowly growing or slowly shrinking and so forth. I mean, many such fields in, you know, in particle physics and in condensed matter physics and so forth. And when you see something like that, what you do is you compute the effective potential energy, the effective integrating out, you know, considering all the fluctuations and other degrees of freedom, and get some energy function of phi, and then dynamics is going to force the theory to sit in a local minimum of phi. You sit someplace up here, you'll quickly radiate away that energy and settle down into the minimum. Okay, so that doesn't say why you live in this one instead of this one, and indeed, in many cases, there are such metastable, local, minima. So the familiar theory of the phase transition, one can have super cool water because you cool it down below the freezing temperature, but without nuclei of crystallization, it could be that the metastable liquid minimum just takes, you know, time to get down to the more stable ice minimum. And so there's nothing, you know, a priori prefer one of these or the other. In that case, if you lower the temperature sufficiently, the barrier will decrease and you'll be able to chomp, but you know, both of them could coexist. Okay, so this is the general story of physics as we understand it, that problems of this sort are controlled by an effective potential, and you have to find a local minima. And when people study landscapes and other branches of physics, they grant that and they start looking for these local minima. Okay, so all we're doing is basically saying the same thing here. You know, we have some information about how to compute an effective potential in string theory. It's not exact, but these things are never exact in real physics. And we do the best we can, and we try to see, you know, how many minima are there. And in particular, this diameter manifold and all the other parameters of the metric and the positions of these bins and everything else are dimensions in the configuration space. And the reason why a particular diameter is picked out is just this. You compute the potential and it's complicated, but it happens to have a minimum there. Okay, well, maybe it also has a minimum there. Why is the diameter this instead of that? Well, we don't know. You know, they're both consistent solutions. It could be that if you started out in this one, although naively, well, indeed it will decay into this lower energy one eventually, perhaps the tunneling barrier makes this take billions of years. You know, we know that the decay of uranium atom takes billions of years. That's why the whole universe be so different. And indeed, you can look at these potential barriers and easily get out far longer lifetimes for such metastable states. So this is the picture. And now having answered this, we've also answered what the term is. You just have to be very clever in computing the effective potential, and that's it. It's the value at the minimum. Okay, and then it's a fair guess that, you know, whichever minimum you consider, the chances that you're going to find this particular non-zero value or any other particular value are infinitesimal. And you can be more precise. You can look at the distribution of lambda values among various minima, and a reasonable conjecture would be that you know, at least anywhere near zero, you know, below these other known scales of physics, that distribution, the number of vacua in a given range, you know, lambda to, you know, lambda plus d lambda, is roughly constant. So the density of the number of possible vacua as a function of the lambda just goes as d lambda. Okay, so that might or might not be true. You could check it if you get more precise information about this effective potential, and it turns out to be true so far as we can know, as far as we've gotten. It looks like a much simpler assumption, such as the idea that there are just many different independent contributions to this vacuum energy, and then standard laws of large numbers were giving distributions of, you know, Gaussian, say, that now we're just looking at some region like this. You know, that's uniform enough for the kind of argument we're talking about. And anyhow, what we will decide from this style of argument is that if we look at any given vacuum, the chances we get it right are almost, you know, nil. But suppose we had now a supply of 10 to the 122 vacua uniformly distributed between m planck to the fourth and minus m planck to the fourth. Well, now that distribution, of course, it becomes quite reasonable to expect a guy of order 10 to the minus 122. Right, just that we have this uniform distribution and we're asking for the expectation value of a vacuum living in that interval, like with 10 to the minus 122. Okay, so that's a candidate explanation of how string theory can contain the vacuum with this tiny cosmological constant. Okay, and so that's certainly at least half of the battle. And if you say that the objective of the game is just to fit the data, that's all the battle. You know, you can argue that vacuum existed in the data. That's what you do. Now you can go on and ask, well, you know, how do we live in that vacuum? And there's a famous anthropic argument due to Steve Weinberg that explains this basically by looking at the consequences of different values of land on structure formation. And if lambda is much bigger, 100 times bigger than this, galaxies cannot form. The cosmological constant becomes important to Berlin. And so it cannot be that much bigger than a universe of general 5.6. So now from that point of view, we might say we don't need too much more explanation. You know, we got the vacuum. We could not live in very different vacuums. This is a candidate explanation. Okay, so that now is answering this question of why a large number of vacuums.
Is this an explanation?
Well, it is. We have to state what we're trying to explain. It's certainly not an explanation of why, from some deeper sense, but it certainly is an explanation of an answer to the question: can we know that string theory? You know, can we convince ourselves that string theory contains a vacuum that fits the data? Well, I regard this as a pretty good argument.
But it also assumes that all the other cosmological parameters, like the density contrast, are fixed.
Oh, it will oversimplify very much. That's right. You should, of course, consider not just this parameter, but everything that you have to fit as a joint problem. And so I oversimplified. This was the original form of the argument. And of course, one could go on to try to make much more sophisticated arguments.
But once you start learning all the other parameters, you get this huge space.
I agree, it's not a simple problem. The basic result that will cut this part of the problem down to size would be to the extent that you could prove that this distribution is decorrelated from the other. That's right. I mean, so precise, to be much more precise, I should really take the whole set of vacua. I should try to compute all the parameters, you know, these discrete data, the 19 parameter standard model. I should restrict attention to the ones for which I fit those correctly and then look at that distribution. And that's a hard problem, but one might be able to show that this feature of the distribution decorrelates with those other choices.
In fact, you're saying that in the end there is no explanation for that 0, 0, so that's what I'm.
Well, those are words. As I say, we didn't get to the end. I'm just trying to decide whether I can, you know, convince myself, you know, yes, string theory contains a vacuum that fits this data number or no. I don't know what kind of explanation I'm supposed to get. I might find a better explanation later, but if it turned out that there were not one, then of course I wouldn't need an explanation either. It would falsify the theory.
Because there is a false correlation. There exists a symmetry which we're looking for.
Oh, definitely. No, I'm definitely not saying that all of the alternatives are disproven. I'm just holding out this one. Yeah. So, okay. So it's obviously important to consider this problem from many points of view. And here's a point of view that does lead to an answer if we grant the existence of this large number of vacuums. But of course, we're not supposed to grant it. We're supposed to really work on this problem with string theory and see if some large number of vacuums exists. Okay, so a nice manageable subset of the problem of determining this potential is the following, which various people have worked on. The idea goes back quite a ways. Among the fields in, you know, all of these string theories are magnetic fields and generalized magnetic fields. And for purposes at hand, we can just think of the usual Maxwell field of Bij, being, you know, a two-form, although it's in 10 dimensions instead of 4 dimensions. Okay, so we know how magnetic field contributes to the energy. Energy, let me write, you know, H for Hamiltonian is E squared plus B squared in this situation, integrated over in the manifold. Okay, so E involves time, that would make Lorentz invariance. But if we postulate magnetic field B only in the internal dimensions, whose, you know, Lorentz, you know, indices only live in these 6 dimensions, that's consistent with 3 plus 1 dimensional Lorentz invariance. So we could postulate some magnetic fields up here and get a non-zero energy which depends on the magnetic field. Okay, so that's some part. You know, there's lots of other parts of this potential. Okay, so now what we then have to ask, of course, is, well, you know, we talked about fixing the diameter. What fixes the value of this magnetic field? But there's a difference between the two problems, where the diameter, the continuous parameter, it turns out that the magnetic field integrated around any topologically non-trivial, you know, any desirable manifold satisfies a quantization condition, the generalization of the original Dirac condition. So there's some electrically charged particle. It can move around and explore this two cycle. Quantum persistency requires that in appropriate units, this such a magnetic field is takes an integer value. Okay, so we didn't determine its value, but it's not a continuous parameter, it's a discrete parameter. And so if we say that it's 2, then it's not going to suddenly jump into 1. That would be some sort of a tunneling process, which again might be suppressed. We can think about that later. Okay, so now we can postulate these magnetic fields and say that for a given manifold with a, in this case, second Betty number, B2, we specify the magnetic field configuration by specifying a vector of B2 integers. Okay, so I'll call these M. I'll take a basis homology and I'll define these integers N sub R to represent the integral of the magnetic field around each of these basis M. Okay, so now I have a B squared contribution to the magnetic field. I have to integrate over the manifold. That's complicated, but that depends on the details of the metric and so forth. But let me write down a simple ansatz for what that dependence might lead to. So the potential is dot, 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 plus something quadratic in these components of B, because this is quadratic. And then some symmetric two-index tensor in this space, some quadratic form. So in effect, we're just taking the length of the vector in some potentially non-trivial metric. Okay, not the space-time metric, something which in principle is again determined by the geometry of this manifold, which we could in principle compute. Okay, so now I have this expression for the potential. If I have all the other ones, let's just idealize those and say that there's just some universal negative lambda zero. Okay, so all the rest of the problem is here more of the lambda zero. Okay, so now the problem of fitting this out of module constant is this is the set of allowed. So the set of V given a vector of these integers, something we call second Betty number K, is the set of allowed cos module constants, this set of discretion of values we talked about over here, does for a given G, this set of allowed values contain a point of this magnitude. Well, let's be more precise about that. Okay, so is V in the set of say minus 10 to 122, 10 minus 122. Okay, so this model. Okay, so what do we say about this model? This is the Russo-Polchinski model, proposed in 2000. And it's an idealization of a class of vacuum, a flux vacuum, and studied in much greater detail. And basically, confirming the sort of picture I'm about to describe from this. Okay, so, well, how do we do this problem? Well, the basic analysis you can do is, what is the picture? The picture is that there's some lattice z to the k, I just projected on two dimensions. Here you have fluxes. Here's zero. Let's draw a shell around the origin of radius lambda zero plus or minus the accuracy bound. So there's some sort of shell using this metric to define the distance. So in general, it'll be an ellipse. And the distance from the origin is lambda zero. And the width is 2 times 10 to the minus 122. Okay, so the question, does V contain a point in this tiny interval, is the question, is there a lattice point that sits in this tiny shell? Okay, so now there's a simple argument that says, suppose there are lots and lots of points, okay? Suppose in particular that the lambda zero got scaled up, the gij got scaled up. Well, equivalently, I could rescale, instead of integer quantizing, I could reduce the quantization unit of the n. It's the same thing. I could gradually fill in the intermediate points in this diagram. And so for some very tiny lattice spacing, I would eventually decide that the number of lattice points that I expected within any shell should be roughly the volume of the shell. Okay, and so unusual integer units, that suggests that what I should do is I should compute the volume of the shell, just in the ordinary, well, metric. And then the expected number of vacua in this range would be the volume of the shell, this lambda 0 to the k over 2, whatever be my definitions, times the Torre factor of that volume of the high dimensional sphere. Okay, so now I have this number of lambda 0, really the ratio between these things. Well, let's grant that these are 1 to 1 to play with. I've just told you that many numbers can be of order, 200. Okay, let's just take that one. Okay, in fact, there is a Lockie apple, which B2 is 204 to the meter to this one. I guess it's 101 to be precise, but I'll put that in. So lambda 0 to the 101. Okay, well, let's suppose lambda 0 in units where this is of order 1 is of order 10 or 11 or 12. Well, then I will predict that a shell of volume, well, some order 1 factor and dimensional constants times this width, that is the volume, and then minus 122, times this factor. Okay, well, let's take this to be 11, say. This will already be greater than 1. So just from this kind of volume estimate, this crude estimate of the number of lattice points containing a volume, because I have a very high dimensional space, it starts to become likely that a vacuum exists even in this tiny interval. And again, it's just this general property of dimensionality you can see in many different pictures. Suppose there are 3 minima in each direction, but I have 500 dimensions, and I predict 3 to the 500 minima. And we're just seeing the same thing. This is at the root of the complications of high dimensional landscapes. But in the case at hand, it leads to a large number of vacua very easily, which only differ in this simplified model in the cosmological constant. And therefore, there should exist some particular choice of main pluses up here for which we really do get a small number, lambda, for the minus 122. And if for some reason, that's where we are. You know, we could not live in a much bigger one. And we don't know why we're there, but at least we fit the data with string theory. Okay, so that's a proposal that gets at this problem, uses a generic feature of string theory, and it really does suggest the existence of a large number of vacua lying to it. Okay, so one can go quite a distance thinking about these ideas and exactly addressing questions such as the one that I got in the audience. Well, now suppose I do put in the other variables. Could they change this argument? Do they correlate with this? Could it be that we actually can make predictions this way? Could it be that different scenarios for how we extend physics beyond the standard model actually interact with this argument in an interesting way? So an example of that would be to say, suppose we considered a whole class of theories where supersymmetry exists, and we will discover supersymmetry at the LHC. It's just right around the corner. Versus the whole other class of theories where supersymmetry is at energies no less than 10 TeV, which is inaccessible to the LHC. Well, it could be that theory class one, SUVI, contains 10 to the 150 vacua, all satisfying the other constraints and uniformly distributed in the cosmological constant. And vacuum class two without supersymmetry contains 10 to the 100 vacua. Okay? Just because supersymmetry, well, this is actually not a crazy thing to say, because if the base point for the cosmological constant is the supersymmetry Rating scale, then the ratio between these numbers is, in fact, the energy density derived from the supersymmetry Rating scale. So this is not at all crazy. Well, now you would combine that with the argument I just made to say that among this class of vacua, we think one does realize the observed cosmological constant, whereas among this class of vacua, we have no reason. Well, we could get down to 10 to the 100, but there's no reason to think there's 10 to the 120. Therefore, if this is the evidence we have at hand, string theory is clearly able to fit the data if we see this, and maybe string theory can't fit the data. There's some reasons I think it can't if we see this. Okay, so that's a possible style of argument that would even lead to predictions in this scenario. Okay, so one can go some distance in exploring this sort of argument. And if there are not vast numbers of vacua, I think one can get predictions of this sort. Okay, so now let me turn to a different question, which is that this was just a kind of statistical argument, and you might not regard it as satisfying. Of course, you might want to really explore in detail the properties of the vacuum that actually works. And so let's pose the question, well, can we actually find, you know, for some given quadratic form GIJ, some given dimension, some given lambda zero, can I exhibit, you know, can I program the computer to find a vacuum which solves this problem? You know, so I looked at the statistical consideration and it predicted 10 to the 20 of them, you know, out of 10 to 140. Okay, so let's just find one. Okay, or let's even be weaker. So let's mathematically prove that one of these guys exists. Okay, so, well, you know, interesting question. It'd be nice to be able to find the right vacuum, having gotten so far. Okay, well, how do you do it? Okay, well, there's one obvious way to do it, which is just to list the various points and start sequentially scanning through them and to see if one works. Okay, so this is a viable algorithm in the sense that it's actually not hard. If you really know this matrix to precision 10 to the minus 120, which we can discuss later, but in principle, if you knew this matrix to that precision, you could plug in a vector and compute this guy and just check this really quickly. Okay, so that's practical. Okay, that's certainly something you can program on your computer. But unfortunately, scanning through all the vacua, we just postulated 10 to 140 vacua, is obviously not feasible. You know, the life of the universe so far is on the order of 10 to the 18 seconds. And even if we have a massively parallel computer running for the age of the universe, we get nowhere near 10 to the 140. Okay, so we can't do it that way. Okay, so that doesn't prove we can't do it, of course. That just proves that we weren't sufficiently clever. Okay, so now how do we know? You know, well, obviously we can start looking up computer science textbooks and see, you know, so what's the algorithm that solves this problem? And indeed, this is quite similar to fairly well-studied problems in computer science. So this whole subject of lattices is an intriguing thing to computer science for various reasons. And there's, for example, something called the shortest vector problem, SVP, which is you're given the same data, GRJ. In fact, you know, we'll just take lambda equals zero, and now you're just asking, you know, does there exist an n such that the length of V is less than some given epsilon? Okay, so it's the related problem where you've got a region like this around the origin instead of the shell. So it looks kind of simple. Okay, and there are other problems in this panel. Okay, so you look up the algorithm to do this, and definitely there are useful things known, but you rapidly learn that problems like this are believed to be intrinsically difficult. So this one is said to be NP complete under randomized reduction. Let me not get into that, but let me describe a slightly simpler problem, which is closely related. It could be considered another toy model for this. So the simplified version of the problem you might consider would be have a potential with a bunch of fields. It's a sum of one parameter potentials over each field. Each one has two minima, zero at one of the minima, and it's some value, vi plus at the other. Okay, so now you just choose a two-value choice of minimum for each field, and you get a list of energies of the same kind of generic one we talked about. You have a set of numbers vi plus playing the role of the gij, and you have a set of numbers n where 0 is the zero energy vacuum and 1 is the vi vacuum. Okay, and now you can ask the same type of question for this. We're given some minus lambda zero, can we fit or approximate zero? Okay, so this is a well-studied problem. Again, this is one of the first problems just discussed in this branch of computer science complexity theory, and this one has been proven to be NP complete. Okay, so what does that mean? This is the legal case of the subset sum problem. Okay, so what does this mean? Okay, so one has to set up a framework. You know, half of the audience, I presume, don't need to say anything about this, but for the benefit of the other half, the having, you know, define, you know, what we mean by a computer program, you know, Turing machine, other things. One of the most basic distinctions we can draw is we give a problem. Let's say we give a decision problem. We're putting in some data, and we want a yes no answer. And we characterize the problem by its size, the number of inputs, you know, the number of digits along, basically, the numbers that we put in. So there's some sort of a input size. And presumably the time to solve the problem for a given algorithm will be a function of the input size. As the input gets one more bigger, it should take longer. And there could be some worst case for a given algorithm, you know, some input that makes it take the maximum length of time. So to be precise, that's what we're discussing. And we're asking, how does the time grow as a function of input size? OK, so in some problems, it grows linearly, quadratically, you know, for sorting a list of n items, it's n log n and so forth. And then one wants all these things where this is a polynomial function into the problem class fit. Okay, so it's a very broad class. A lot of important distinctions are not captured, but one thing, you know, there are lots of nice things about simplifying the problem to this extent. It's invariant under the actual choice of computer that you use, and so forth. And now we can distinguish it from problems that, for example, take exponential time in the worst case and other such classes. Okay, so this is not either of these. It's not non-polynomial. What NP is saying, it stands for non-deterministic polynomial, but the best way to say what NP is saying about your class of problems is basically that you can check the answer quickly. Okay, so an NP problem is something where we're given the input. Okay, and you know, the program is supposed to produce the yes or no output. And then informally, well, if we're given the right answer, you know, we could be given anything. We'll say if I have a widget. So given a particular input, there's something I can tell you, in this case, you know, the actual set of boxes, that you could check very quickly and check, yes, I did answer the question properly. So in the case at hand, well, I give you the N and you just compute very quickly in this formula and indeed satisfy the condition. Okay, so answer is checkable in polynomial time. Okay, I'm saying, you know, nothing regarding that how long it takes to find the answer. Obviously, if you couldn't even check the answer in polynomial time, you would be pretty sure you had a difficult problem to do. But suppose you can check it quickly, that doesn't prove that you can find it quickly. Okay, so now the claim, of course, about the problem at hand, this problem initially, this problem is that we think it's harder than P, and we can argue that by showing that all the NP problems, you know, any problem that falls into this category, if I can find a solution for this, just this class of problems, of course, an arbitrary set of numbers, size of the input, then I could solve all the NP problems. I could solve things that people have been working for many years to solve. And I think because of time, I won't go into details of the subsequent arguments. But the style of the argument is that, you know, what does this tell us? Okay, so I want to show, first of all, that some problem is NP complete. Let me choose as a canonical nice choice of problem the SAD, or satisfiability problem. Okay, how could I show that this problem is complete? Well, what is the problem, first of all? The problem is that I've given Boolean variables, let's call them X of I, they can be true or false. And I'm given some list of logical propositions which are constructed from AND or NOT, things like X1, 4, X7, NOT, X7, or X15, and so forth. Let's just say we have a bunch of lists of ORs of this sort, and now the question is, can I find a set of true false items that satisfies all of these simultaneously? Okay, so then what's the size of the input? Well, number of these clauses, number of variables. how can you do it? Well, you could try all the possibilities. You know, again, that goes as exponential of the number of variables. So that's kind of slow. Now it is to trying all the possibilities here, exponential of the number of fluxes. Well, that's in our part. Is there something better? Well, we don't know, but what is true is if you tell me a list, I can just plug them into the logical expressions, take the end and check and see if you're correct. Okay, so it definitely is in this class NP. Okay, so what does it mean for it to be NP complete? Well, to explain that, basically I would pick the program that checks. So there's some program up here which I'm given the problem of the input to the problem, I'm given the witness. You know, so in the case at hand, the particular set of variables, in this case, the particular set of fluxes, you know, whatever it is that's supposed to convince me that it's true, that I could check. And now I have a program that does this in polynomial time and tells me, yes, I may get a correct solution or not. Okay, so such a thing does exist for any NP problem by definition. Okay, now if I have such a thing, the basic idea is I could say, let's just consider the actual running of the computer. So some complicated thing with registers or tapes in the Turing machine and some sequence of stats for first time work here. You know, I keep running through the program. But I have some definite logical relations between each step and the next. And so the claim that such a program runs and produces a yes does correspond to some definite logical sequence of operations, which I could describe in a logical framework like this. I could say, well, yes. You know, this element under tape is one, and if that's one, this has to be one, unless I do such and such in the program. I can make some long but still polynomial length program, because the program only took polynomial in many steps, and get a big problem of this sort. Okay, so now you would think, well, that's going to take forever. Well, it won't take polynomial time to run it for one of these things, but let's suppose I could just run it with this as a free variable and ask, well, is there ever a solution to this thing? Okay, well, that's, if I had a problem that could solve, a program that could solve this in generality, that's just what I can do. I just feed this thing in, use this as free variables, and it would tell me, yes, there is one. No, there is not. So if I could solve this problem in polynomial time, I could feed any program that this says and solve them all. So that's this idea of NP completeness, and what I just described is a reduction of the general NP problem to a SAT problem. And therefore, if we had this polynomial time program to solve SAT problems, we would have a great thing. You know, we would not only have $1 million in the Play Foundation, we could solve an incredible variety of very, what we think are very hard problems. And so, of course, this tends to make people think, pessimists that they are, that such a thing probably doesn't exist. Well, we don't know. Nobody proved it didn't exist. But this is the famous P is not equal to NP problem. You can just establish it for one of these guys, and you've established for this whole class, including the subset sum problem. There's a detailed argument in our paper. This is all with Frederick Dana on the web. And very similar, really just adapting the known ideas for this Bousso-Polchinski problem. Okay, so in fact, you can even just get it down to the case where, so what's the claim that we have to prove? Well, it's clearly a problem in NP, but is it NP complete? Okay, well, that means that given any SAT problem, you know, because we can skip this step, we show we can turn this into SAT. So now I say, give me a SAT problem, can I then find a lambda 0 and a matrix G such that the hypothetical Bousso-Polchinski machine could then, you know, that solves that problem, you know, would then implicitly solve this problem. I could translate any solution to this back into that, just as I could translate the logical expressions that operate, that correspond to this program into the existence or not of this witness. Okay, well, it's a fairly similar problem to this one if you make two modifications. Well, you just consider the diagonal matrix here. You just consider the entries GI, JI not equal to J, 0. So you get a sum that looks like this, and then the GI is these variables. And then you need to put in some extra structure that forces these variables in to take the value 0 or 1. And it turns out you can do that by modifying the style of argument that one has here. And so it's fairly straightforward to show that the computer that can solve all these problems, and in particular behind the vacuum with the small cosmological constant, no matter how small it might be, no matter how many boxes there are and so forth, again, there's this very powerful, you know, in polynomial time, there's this very powerful thing that proves P equals P, which is not what we believe exists. Okay, so that's the sort of rigorous result one can get in this complexity theory. Now, in principle, one could go quite a bit farther and talk about the loophole to this. Okay, so now if we really take the most pessimistic interpretation of what I said, it would be to say that the structure of this problem is such that there really is nothing better than exhaustive search. You know, and we're just never going to search for even 10 to 120 Dirichlet exhaustively defined p by 1. So to the extent that the problem reduces to this, we might well decide from two other means, or these statistical means, that the vacuum probably exists. You know, maybe we'll even see a cosmic string out there, you know, something which would only fit by string theory, and convince ourselves that it's string theory. But now we want to get down to the end of the story and say, well, you know, it's not only string theory, it's this Galois and these brains and this set of boxes, and we would just never be able to find. Okay, so it's a kind of crazy possibility, and one starts to look for loopholes. So one looks for loopholes both from the practical, or the point of view that I'm taking, the string theorist that wants to find the right vacuum. One might also look for loopholes from the point of view of what might sound like a paradox. Okay, so we just said here is this immensely difficult problem which no computer, even running for the age of the universe and filling the universe, could solve. But evidently, the universe did solve the problem because we are here. And it did produce this small cosmological constant according to this theory. Well, is there some sort of a paradox in that? How did the universe find this small thing? That's the whole power of the universe, considered as a computer, is insufficient to do it. And that's in principle the subject of our paper too, which may come out someday. There's a lot of interesting situations that this brings you into. I think time probably doesn't permit me to go very deeply into this. Obviously, the most straightforward answer you can get to this question within the framework I was describing is to say that, well, suppose it really does exist a multiverse, some sort of a theoretical structure within string theory that in some sense produces all of the vacua simultaneously. Well, of course, we can't observe any of this, it's just metaphysics. But now we don't have to think of the universe as having that one unique, or however many unique candidate vacua there are, they're all somehow out there, and we live in one that solves this problem. Okay, so that's an interesting response one can take, and it makes the whole thing sound sort of vacuous. Okay, now, again, time doesn't permit, but it was a paper of Scott Aronson here that convinced us that this is not vacuous. Okay, so a paper that he wrote that shows that even given this type of anthropic condition, and you can make it more precise by saying, let's suppose we're granted a computer or even a quantum computer where we're allowed to post-select on the output. Okay, so what's the caricature of the anthropic argument, which many of you probably thought about? Well, quantum mechanics in some sense might predict that all these branches, all these possible universes exist, and you can build a computer that tries to solve a problem. It's very easy to build a computer that tries out different possibilities and different branches and should find a solution in one branch. You just make these choices in a sort of non-deterministic way, as in the terminology we started with here. That's not a quantum computer by any normal definition of the world, because we almost never live in the branch where it's solved the problem. The probability we do is exponentially small. But suppose you pose a left and you say, if I don't get the right answer, I'm going to kill myself. So you look at, there's a light on the computer, and it's either green or it's red. And as soon as you see red, bang. And then there's some branch in your response where it's green, and you're alive, and you have the answer. And it's, you know, sounds ludicrous, but indeed, you can formalize this concept. And it is a reasonable model for this Anthropic type of argument where, you know, it's clear we only live in a bigger universe. We can only live in a universe where this answer came out right. We are allowed to put that factor into our considerations. Okay, well, so now I'm like, way more precise, just got to be more precise, the type of reasoning I just discussed. And he shows that, in fact, you can't solve all problems with polynomial time with such a computer. There are problems that we believe, always, you know, using conjectures of this type, are too hard for such a thing. And then that raises the possibility that, well, even with the Anthropic argument in the game, there might be cosmological models which you would convince yourself could not, you know, if we think the universe is a computer, you know, it should not be able to solve the problem that that cosmological model solved. And so the basic example that we get in our paper is an interesting one because it's one that a lot of people have taken seriously. So there's this idea of the wave function that you know, it's a big wave function that is a function of all the possibilities that are there. And we're supposed to square it. And we're supposed to get the probability that somehow the universe was created with a given quality and a different getting cosmological time and all that. And you know, maybe this is the thing which we have to know to cut through this terrible search problem. Okay, if we just knew which was the type of universe that this probability function peaked on, we would be in much better shape, wouldn't we? Okay, well, obviously it sounds like a very hard problem, but a remarkable number of people have proposed the same general answer for the form of this wave function. Okay, it's very simplified analysis, but if what comes out of, for example, the Hartle-Hawkins type of prescription, for those who know what that is, and the answer is that the wave function and the probability of their approximation depend only on the cosmological constant of the vacuum and go as exponential of a computable constant, 24 pi and length to the fourth, I believe, over the cosmological constant. Okay, so that's it. That's the wave function of the universe. And you know, this, you know, obviously a result that has to be treated with the you know, most respect and skepticism. You know, famous jokes of Marie Gilman, you know, the wave function of the universe and why aren't we rich? And so anyhow, here it is. And people have, you know, debated. Most people don't really believe this, but let's just preempt it for the moment. Hey, I suppose this was it. Okay. Well, this, especially under, if you can show that the distribution of cosmological constants is this, you know, I'll add in one more thing. It's only got support on positive lambda. So lambda has to be positive. And it sounds like a bit of a cheat, but there actually are theoretical reasons why it might be that way. Okay. So let's just preempt that. Okay. So given any reasonable distribution of lambdas among vacua, this is incredibly highly weighted on the minimum positive lambda. You know, you can just check it. This is 10 to the minus 122. This is e to the 10 to the 122. And that is hugely greater than, for example, e to the 10 to the 122 divided by 2. So obviously, it's a very well peaked wave function. It's a very precise prediction. We live in the minimum positive type. Stephen Hawking's paper on this was cosmological confidence, probably zero. Okay, so let's just, you know, take this at face value and, you know, not, you know, exploring what this says about the broader scheme of things. Of course, it suggests that there had better already be about 10 to 122 vacua, you know, for this to actually be the value that we see. Let's suppose things turn out that way. Okay, well, how do we find that value? Okay, well, you know, on the basis of it, you know, it's an equally well-posed problem. You know, here's our function in our point model. And now we're trying to ask the conjunction of this and v for the given value of n is less than v for all the other. Okay, so from this version of the problem, insisting that it be positive, and I'm asking that it be the minimum. Okay, so it's a well-posed problem. And a little bit of thinking will convince you that this problem is not obviously an NP. Okay, so what was the definition of NP? You could at least check the answer in polynomial time. You know, so you plug in the N and you do the check. You have a small value, but do you have the smallest value? Well, that's not terribly obvious. You really might even just have to check all the other ones.
On the other hand, it will be solvable by a quantum computer with fuzzy selection.
That's right. We saw it by quantity with post selection, but not with anthropic post selection. Okay, so by that I mean, suppose we are not allowed to post select on an arbitrary output variable, one which is required for our existence and by any reasonable argument, then you can easily construct models of this type where you can't fit. That's right. So it's not literally your result, but it's applying the same. That's right. That's right. So the precise class that this guy lives in is DK. You could produce a computer using post selection that solves it, but it's not anthropic post selection anymore. Now it's just a weird kind of post selection. So you can have this combination of what theoretically is the most predictive principle at all with even worse computational aspects. And so I think, I don't know how long these things usually go, but you start to get the flavor of this. And nevertheless, I'm an optimist, and I think we will be able to make predictions, at least of the statistical sort, out of string theory. But keeping very well fixed in our mind the things that we can compute and not compute. And of course, we might discover direct evidence for against the theory as well. So I certainly would not call this some sort of obstacle or argument that you can't test string theory. But conceivably, an argument at the end of the day, we won't know all the characteristics of the correct vacuum. So I'll stop there.
Are there any questions? No, okay. Josh, go ahead.
We can't tell the point of view that possibly string theory doesn't solve this problem because of Legend Constant. But there may be some other way of doing it.
It's a subject of any possible logical
advantage. But the idea of doing physics and solving this problem of physics, as we've traditionally done in the history of physics. For example, maybe we have to reinterpret what we understand by the vacuum. There may be a symmetry there. People are looking for this. So one shouldn't quit.
That's an obstacle.
Ultimately, with this approach, strings are the same. You end up with a box of molecules, and we're doing statistical mechanics with the theory. That's all there is.
Well, it's better than that.
I find that unpalatable. But that's my question.
Okay. Well, I certainly agree that you shouldn't quit, and some fraction of the community shouldn't quit. And this is all still kind of speculative. And on the other hand, we will, some of us will pursue this and see to what extent it makes sense and can be tested.
How seriously can you take this picture of the universe as a sort of classical theory, given that it seems to be solving continuous problems, like solving Young-Mills equations?
That's right. There's a lot that can be said about it, and there are a few steps of that sort. I mean, I think one knows that for interesting physical problems, one can put a quantum field theory on a lattice and get results of a given desired accuracy. And so I think the answer is that by making that type of argument precise, you can regard it as such. But I don't think really precise arguments are out there yet.
So, given that many dynamics have so huge problems for making predictions, there is this four-dimensional string theory developed a few years ago.
I too have this kind of sneaking suspicion that this is telling us that this theory is just more complicated than data. We would be happier with something that produced a rank 4 gauge group and somehow solved this problem either by the sort of mystery mechanism that John and many others would like, or perhaps it only has 10 to 120 vacuum instead of 10 to the 500. That would be progress from this point of view. And I encourage you to develop it. I don't think there's
So there was this paper, I don't know, 3-4 years ago by Thomas Dieter, that string theory
Well, okay, I...
Or just brute force decision?
Yeah, I certainly didn't study it. People I talked to, I mean, whether something to pick out four as opposed to any other dimension, or...
Well, you just show that, in fact, you can do it.
He picked four.
You can take...
Yeah, no, no, most thinkers don't think that's right for a combination of reasons. Again, I have not looked at the data in detail, so I'll leave it to others to comment. But I certainly think that the general idea of searching for a string that either naturally makes sense in four, or perhaps naturally makes sense in six, and the number of extra two-dimensional manifolds is obviously very much smaller. You know, a simpler theory in this class is what's a well-motivated thing to look for.
If you can do four-dimensional string theory, you violate relations.
That's right. The existing, for all the existing non-critical strings, of course, do it by postulating the Majorcon. They violate Lorentz invariance. So it's not a known theory. I mean, Tiemann claimed his didn't. And, you know, people occasionally do make this sort of claim. You know, another one which you might resurrect is that, of course, nobody literally proved that, you know, n equals eight supergravity in four dimensions had divergences. You know, we all think it does, but maybe it's finite. It's got a rank four gauge group, not the right one, but maybe that's closer to the ballpark. I mean, yeah, definitely. I think too little work is done on alternatives to string theory. More people should be working on alternatives. But it's also true that in the last 10, 20 years, studying string theory seems to look like more than the study of the alternatives.
I was going to say that strikes me as a very much of a string theorist question of what is it that picks out four if it does not a number of dimensions.
Well, yeah, it's a question. It's not even a question for anybody doing fundamental physics. I mean, there are definitely, you know, simple arguments for four, but they're very old, you know, quasi-anthropic arguments for four. So,
Thank you.